Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit Simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Live at the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C., you're listening to The Tidbit, brought to you by Curate. I'm your host and the CEO of Curate, Kim Bryden. Do you run a small business or have dreams to start one? Here at The Tidbit, we've got your back. Each week, we talk through tidbits of knowledge around starting or running a small business with a food and beverage lens. Being entrepreneurial, I believe, is pretty core to our humanness. We've grown as a species, you know, for many reasons, but frankly, because of our curiosity, our ability to adapt, for our ingenuity, for our dreams of being able to look beyond what is currently known. And over the next two episodes of The Tidbit, I want our imaginations to soar. What are the fields emerging in the food and beverage industry broadly that we can begin to think up new ventures and new ways of approaching challenges that are encroaching upon us as a society today? So to best frame this first conversation on innovation, here are two headlines that landed this month around policies from two major city governments. So headline one, goodbye plastic straws, DC's ban is now in effect. DC banned plastic straws in restaurants and other businesses effective January 1st, 2019, becoming the second major U.S. city to do so. Seattle made the change 6 months ago. Plastic straws won't disappear immediately, however. Businesses have until July to make the transition to alternatives before fines kick in. And the second headline reads, Cuomo to propose plastic bag ban. Andrew Cuomo said this past Sunday that his 2019 executive budget will include a ban on single-use plastic bags. So let's do a little brainstorm here. Let's tease out what could this possibly mean, the ripple effects of these policies. So how will this change consumers' consumption habits? What did we learn about consumer behavior change when Bloomberg implemented the soda tax? Will people be willing to pay more for a reusable bag? Will we see more people carrying around metal straws and utensils? And if that's the case, are we going to need to create a bespoke dishwashing station in bathrooms for people to clean their wares before exiting a space? What will happen to the factories creating plastics? Is it only possible to see change when policies are enacted and enforced, or do we need a seismic shift from corporations as well? And who puts the pressure on the corporations to change? With this demand to decrease usage of single-use plastics, where else are we seeing a shift along the supply chain outside of tangible products like straws and bags? There's just so many questions that you can tease from a headline. There's so many questions. And within each of those questions is a business opportunity. What strikes you as interesting? Where do you see a market gap? Really think about, what is the beginning of these movements that we're starting to embark upon? So on today's show, I'm really excited to explore new market opportunities and innovations along the supply chain, from product to packaging to new retail models, with Jennifer Goggin. Jen has been an entrepreneur and advisor in the food industry since 2010, and she's now a co-founder of Startle, an innovation studio for the food ecosystem. We're going to take a quick break and then jump in with Jen. You're listening to The Tidbit, and we're here with Jennifer Goggin, co-founder of Startle, an innovation studio for the food system based out of New York City. Am I correct there, Jen? Hey.
Yep, that's right. How are you?
Thanks for joining us today.
Of course, my pleasure.
We know each other through a Women in Food Mastermind group comprised of some really kick-ass ladies across the states who work at different parts of the food supply chain. So, Jen, I am familiar with your background, but please, can you tell us more about your experiences to date that have led you to this moment in your food journey? I'd love for our listeners to learn more about your origin story.
Sure. There's been some twists and turns in it. So before my current company, I started two other ventures. The first one began as an online marketplace that connected chefs and farmers and eventually morphed into a software as a service platform that helped farmers and growers manage their wholesale business. I worked on that for about 5 years before leaving to explore a different piece of the food puzzle. And what I decided to tackle next was the question of why, even though there was a lot of consumer demand for local food, it wasn't actually all that easy to buy that local food. As much as I love farmers markets and CSAs, they just aren't that convenient for a lot of people's schedules. So I built my second company, which helped get local and regional food in the doors of where people were already shopping, namely big grocery store chains, but it also kept the provenance of that food front and center and accurate with the digital Know Your Farmer platform in those stores. Mm. Pretty early on, that company was acquired by another food tech startup, and so I joined them for about a year to integrate my platform with theirs. And so those two experiences were about, I think, seven or eight years. And throughout those years, I learned so much about building and growing and exiting companies and startups and from the business side. But I also learned a lot about the food and ag industry in general beyond just the little pieces of it that I was working on. And like you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it was so clear that there are so many big challenges to tackle and opportunities that come out of those. So after I left the second company, I decided to co-found Startle with my two partners. And the idea is that we can use our collective experience to help other entrepreneurs, scientists, even large food corporations or investors bring the best new ideas and technologies to market in order to transform our food system, hopefully for the better.
Love this. And just to point out or clarify a piece of your journey, what you were really focused on, you mentioned this, but learning more about ag and tech. So the local foods that you were working with were really farmer centric. And so learning more about the trials and tribulations of what does happen from literally farm to grocery store. So I just wanted to put that extra point of clarification because what I'm really interested in hearing your perspective on, I'm in our mastermind group. We had the opportunity to talk with Nada Grocery, which is based in Vancouver. And it's a grocery store that empowers shoppers to decrease food waste and unnecessary packaging. And so anyway, we'll get to your retail experience in a moment, but this new packaging, or I should say this no packaging or reduction of single-use plastic packaging in retail is growing. And from my understanding, it started in Berlin with original Unverpackt, I might be saying this wrong, which was the first zero-waste grocery store in the world. And as I just mentioned at the top of the show, DC just banned the use of single-use plastic straws. So clearly we're seeing this conscious consumerism growing. So tell us more about your observations of these new retail models, especially in this waste reduction space.
Yeah, sure. So I will say hopefully miles are also decreasing.
Oh, yeah.
The miles between the farm and you. Mm-hmm. But the no packaging retail model is certainly spreading. I know that there's a, you know, it's not food, but it's a home goods no packaging store in Brooklyn that's opened. There is a food focused one called The Fillery, which I think did a Kickstarter campaign either a year or two ago, and they're currently looking for a space in Brooklyn as well. And I would expect to just see more of those crop up across the country. But there's also a different example of how retail stores can help reduce food waste. And that is called, or one of them is called the Daily Table in Boston. And the Daily Table works with a network of growers and food manufacturers to sell whatever excess product or produce that those players have at a very affordable price. So, you know, taking food that is perfectly good, but either is near the end of its shelf life or almost expired, and bringing that to people that can still eat and enjoy it. And then if you want to branch out even from retail to restaurants, there's a company I heard of in Portland that provides reusable takeout containers for vendors and for customers. So they, you know, they take care of the whole life cycle of collecting those containers, washing them, and then redistributing them back into their network to be used again. And I can see that having a huge impact in the amount of plastic, or reducing the amount of plastic that we all use when we order our takeout. I would point out, though, you know, I do think there's a big challenge kind of facing all of these new initiatives. And the big challenge for this, the zero waste movement, is to design it into people's lifestyles, because there's so often this gap between intention and action. And the reality is, as much as people might have really good intentions, to actually get them to act on that means that, generally means that the solution has to be just as easy or convenient as the old way of doing things. You know, so if you think about all these zero packaging grocery stores, customers now need to remember to bring all the various containers that they need for each product. But in real life, you know, people stop by the grocery store on their way home from work. Maybe it's an impromptu trip, or maybe they're shopping and then they remember an item that they, you know, they didn't have on their list and they don't have a container with them. So the question for me is, how can you enable those last minute or spur of the moment purchases within this new no packaging paradigm?
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, no, well, it's just, there's a lot of complications to it. If you, you know, kind of what you were doing with when you start with the headline of no straws, what does that really mean, and where are all the ripple effects to it? And you could even get a little more complicated and expand on those challenges, because that idea of the design aspect is really just one of three key pieces that I think you need to enable big system and behavioral shifts. There's the technical aspect, the business aspect, and then the design aspect. Mm. And so for food waste, I think we're really on our way with the technical solutions. Like, you know, there are a lot more recyclable materials available. People are working on plastic alternatives. There are companies like Appeal that has created a bio-coating that keeps produce fresher longer. These, you know, the new retail models we just talked about are great examples of the new business models. And even simply making customers pay for, you know, every plastic bag that they use at the store will also, is a, you know, a business economic way to change behavior. But the design aspect, I think, still has room for improvement. And so, like I said before, for the consumer to reduce waste and avoid plastic or packaging, it really has to be very easy and convenient. And I'm not sure that we've seen any large-scale solutions that are successfully designed for that yet.
That is fascinating. And yeah, I feel like in order to really change consumer behavior, you either have to shame someone, unfortunately, right? Like, why are you still carrying your plastic straw? Or you make it as convenient as possible. Or there's even this larger player that is forcing somebody's hand and making that change. I'll just draw an example that Johns Hopkins University has a commitment to green solutions. And so if they receive any catering order, it cannot come in plastic or styrofoam. It has to arrive in compostable packaging. And so that is a great, let's say, mandate from a larger institution. And that also means that they have to spend a bit more, I mean, maybe marginally, because they're now not using the cheaper alternatives for packaging. So it really does mean that you have to think about, like you're saying, all of those business and convenience ripple effects across all of the players, because you can say, please don't use plastic anymore. But then are you going to buy? You know, are you going to be able to afford that uptick in the cost of that package? And I'll just bring out one other example that maybe you have experience with. A lot of beverage producers really want to create their package in glass bottles, but glass bottles are really expensive to ship. And so if you're trying to think about starting a beverage business and you have dreams of being nationwide, you have to consider, is it possible for me to really run a business using glass bottles? Because I don't know if I can realistically afford that, or if my end consumer wants to afford that extra shipping and handling cost. So yeah, it's really fascinating to see where rubber meets the road, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think that's also part of the, you know, what those examples that you brought up, that kind of gets to the question of scale. So a lot of these things, you know, a lot of these initiatives are doable at a smaller scale. So like Johns Hopkins can do that at their university, for example, or one small local beverage maker could do that within, you know, their local market. But then if you want these things to really take effect at a large mass scale across the country, then you have to start thinking about, well, how does this solution scale up, and does it scale up, and again, does it make sense for people to want to do it, as opposed to, you know, forcing them to do it?
Well, yeah, totally. And I was just positing, is it even possible for us to detangle ourselves from plastics at such a degree now, when plastic is so tied to our fossil fuels, and how much like gas and oil is just so integrated into our economic engine of the United States. And so I think it's also really interesting that cities or states are coming up with their own green initiatives. But then what does that mean in contrast to federal policies? And so anyway, I'm going on a thread here, but if we're starting to see more states take ownership of what their policies and what they're regulating, down to, again, an anchor institution creating policies, does that then create more new market opportunities in only specific areas, like geographic areas? Does that then enforce certain like wealth inequality gaps, or even health inequality gaps, because certain areas of the country are more focused on these new market opportunities than others? So it's really interesting to not, you know, to see this in a micro lens, but also to pull back and see, where is this actually going to affect like society at large and business at large for cities that adopt a trend or don't?
Yeah, for sure.
So many things to think about today.
So many things.
We are going to take a quick break and then get into more nitty-gritty around where we're seeing, again, products and packaging and new ingredients along the supply chain in waste reduction and plastic reduction. So we'll take a quick break and be right back. You're tuning into The Tidbit. I'm Kim Bryden, the host and CEO of Curate, and we're sitting down with Jennifer Goggin, an entrepreneur and advisor in the food industry since 2010, and now a co-founder of Startle, an innovation studio for the food system. Hello, Jen.
Hi, Kim.
I was just going on this thread of macro trends affecting us all. And even though it may sound scary and daunting, it's possible everyone may not agree with this statement, but I really do believe that we're in an awesome moment of time right now where we have the opportunity to innovate and iterate on these new challenges. I don't see the dauntingness that is before us as scary. In fact, I think, to quote another person, I think we should lean into the big opportunities that are coming our way. Yeah. And so we just talked about new retail models, but how about the actual supply chain? So how can we fundamentally change the way we look at how goods are produced or packaged? What have you been researching at Startle?
Yeah, there's a lot. And I also just want to quickly say I agree with your way of looking at this, where it's there are a lot of negatives, but there are so many positives, and it's more exciting, I think, than scary. So that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
One of the really cool trends that we've seen on the supply chain side is reclaiming the byproducts of food production. So I'll give you a few examples to kind of make clear what that means. There's a company or a startup called Fora Foods, which makes a non-dairy butter out of aquafaba. And aquafaba is the leftover water that is left behind after you soak chickpeas. So I think they work with a large hummus maker who was probably before just pouring that product down the drain after they soaked their chickpeas, and now it's being turned into this really delicious vegan butter. There are also a few startups working on making products using the spent grain that results from brewing beer. And then there's another startup going the other direction, making beer using surplus bread. And then there's, last month I came across another startup that's using the byproduct of vegetable oil extraction to make a very high protein flour that can be then used in a whole bunch of different baked goods. And what I think is brilliant about this shift is that it's not just about doing good for the planet, but it also makes business sense for current food manufacturers. So they get an additional source of revenue from something that they would have just otherwise thrown away. And it also makes sense for the consumer because at least the majority of what I've seen so far, these new products that are being created have a really impressive nutritional profile. And if you think about it, the shift is really just the business corollary of that idea of nose to tail or root to stem dining, where, why only use one part of an ingredient when all the parts have different value in different ways? So I think that's one shift in the supply chain that I'm really excited about. Another change that I don't know is happening yet, but I really want to see happen, is the way in which we assign value to produce. Mm. So right now, the price points are pretty much just based on labels or certifications. So a carrot is either organic or not organic. But there's really so much more nuance that affects the quality and the type of produce that we buy. So, when farmers are planting their crops, they can select what seeds they want to plant based on a ton of different traits, including how fast that plant grows, how resistant to pests it is, and how good it tastes, although that is less prioritized in most cases. And
such
if
a
you
shame.
Think about how, I know, it really is, it's so sad, although I know Dan Barber, I think this is his big crusade right now, so that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And another piece of it is the soil health. So how healthy the soil is on a farm almost directly impacts how nutritious that produce will be that comes out of that soil. And then there's the time between the harvest and consumption, of course, impacts the nutrition level. So a carrot that it has been harvested yesterday will be more nutritious than a carrot that was harvested a month ago. So, as I consider what outcome we're actually trying to get to encourage from both a consumer demand perspective but also an environmental perspective, flavor and nutrition jump out as two characteristics of produce that, consumers want, of course, but also those two characteristics tend to mean very high-quality farming methods were used to grow that produce. And those, flavor and nutrition are measurable. So at least the beginnings of the technology exists now. You can use spectroscopy to measure the nutrient content of a single carrot, for example.
Mm.
You can take a Brix measurement on a carrot to see how much sugar is in it or how sweet it is, which is one component of flavor. So I'd love to see a supply chain that assigns greater value to produce grown in better conditions and that are therefore generally healthier and more enjoyable to eat, regardless of what label it carries. How we do that, of course, I don't have an answer for it just yet, but I think, I think things are slowly starting to shift in that direction.
That is fascinating. And as you were talking about even the time between harvest and consumption, my brain went in the direction of, What if there was an ability to create dynamic pricing, almost like an Uber surge model, where if it was harvested, I don't know, this week, it was cheaper. And as the longer it sits on the shelf, I don't know, maybe the opposite. I have to think about this. This is just my first idea off the top of my head.
yeah, but that's totally the point. Like, so if that carrot is on the shelf and it is, so let's say you've got two organic carrots sitting side by side, mm-hmm. and one was grown from a, you know, very, very large scale organic farm across the country that is certified organic, but maybe doesn't fully adhere to the real back to basics principle of organics. And then you've got that other organic carrot that was grown from a farm up the road, harvested yesterday, and they do, you know, all sorts of different things to keep the health of their soil. That second organic carrot is probably better for you and tastes better than the first carrot, but you can't, as a consumer, differentiate between the two right now. So like if you could somehow do that and then pay more for the one that you as a consumer provide, ascribe more value to, I think that would be awesome.
Yes. Ooh, wow. I'm coming up with new market opportunities here. So in all of your research and development at Startle, let's keep going on this. What are additional market areas of opportunity you've noticed? I mean, I personally just read an interesting article about Nestle patenting a red seaweed substitute for traditional dairy creamers. Very interesting. And I feel like the sea has a lot to open up for us. So what have you explored?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think plant-based everything is certainly a hot area right now. But at Startle, we're focused on kind of four broad areas of opportunity. The first one is the supply chain. The second one is the personalization of food. The third is how food and health interact. And then the fourth is the intersection of food and culture, which admittedly overlap quite a bit with the other three. So within the supply chain, in addition to everything we've already talked about, we're very interested in smart packaging, both for food safety and for traceability purposes. Mm-hmm. So one example that we've looked into quite closely is it's a technology that's a DNA patch that can detect pathogens like E. coli and salmonella within packaged meat and poultry. So clearly that we see a lot of applications for that, and it could do a lot to protect consumers against foodborne illnesses, which has been, you know, there's been quite a lot of news about that in the past year, but there's a lot to work out still in terms of how it fits in with the current processes of manufacturers and retailers. Mm. And then within food and health, for example, we are really intrigued by functional foods and nutraceuticals, which is really just a fancy
nutraceuticals.
Term for, it sounds super fancy. It's basically just food that provides some kind of medicinal or health benefit beyond its nutrition. So we really want to explore how these types of foods can be used in a preventative way that makes sense for each individual. Which then starts dovetailing with personalization. So all of our areas of focus really kind of intersect with each other quite a bit. But so the personalization idea is that everybody, you know, has different nutritional and medicinal needs depending on not only the individual makeup of their body, but also depending on what is going on with their body at that moment in their life, mm-hmm. Which is constantly changing, of course. So there inherently can't be a one-size-fits-all solution, but that's what makes it fun.
You know, as a lady over here, I want to also reference not just stage of life that you're in, but also, hello, cycles of the month. You know, mm-hmm. there are all these applications where we've been told or been instructed that it is this one size fits all, even the way your diet should be. Right. The food pyramid, right? And I think this is so smart that as our technologies are just becoming way more affordable even, mm-hmm. how can we create these plans for ourselves that are not just specific to our current stage of life, meaning age, but also even within a month, like how are you feeling, whether it's you're sick or you're going through your normal cycle. So I think that's wildly smart, and I'm really excited to see how that field emerges too.
Yeah, me too.
So instead of thinking about creating solutions to current problems, which I think we get caught up in quite frequently, even on a macro level of maybe even people creating a problem when there wasn't a problem to begin with, and then trying to come up with a solution that's unnecessary. Anyway, tangent. But what are some tips that you have for entrepreneurs who do want to create solutions for problems that are coming down the pipeline? Any tips or tricks that you can provide?
Yeah. So I would say you should imagine how the food system should look in 20 years. And actually, side note, I was at a workshop recently where the host set the stage for the day by pointing out that all the future scenarios you ever see portrayed in popular culture or written about are always dystopian, which is kind of back to your point of, like, there's a lot of doom and gloom and, you know, people are not feeling great about the future. And it is always portrayed as so dark. Mm-hmm. But I guess what I'd say is imagine what you hope the food system will look like in 20 years, or would want it to look like in 20 years, and then build for that vision. So build what you can, assuming that system would be in place for 20 years, and kind of by default, you are helping to design the system in that direction. But I would say that current problems, they certainly need solutions as well. So for entrepreneurs looking to tackle those problems, I would reiterate the importance of design thinking that we talked about earlier. So make sure that your solution is not something people feel like they have to do or use out of obligation, but make it something that it would really be silly for them to not use.
Wow. So if people want to learn more about you and your journey as you're continuing to innovate and find out about these really awesome new solutions, how can we find you, online or otherwise?
Good question. I suppose Twitter is probably the best. My Twitter handle is at Jen, JennGoggin, or our website is startleinnovation.com.
Amazing. Thank you for being with us today. Listener, this show is based on a bi-weekly newsletter that we send out at Curate called The Tidbit, obviously. And in it, we discuss what we're reading, eating, drinking, listening to, and learning. A lot of what we're observing in these new innovations, we add into the newsletter. So head over to curate.co, CUREATE.co, and sign up today. And until next time, everyone, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.